It's another Friday afternoon, and you are tuned to another episode of The Sideshow at Sideshow on Twitter, facebook.com/TheSideshow and Sideshow.com. Let me think. You'll hear a little bit of noise in the background. You'll hear sirens, traffic, all of those things. I'm in London. What had actually happened was I was sitting on the far side of the road having a cup of coffee with my good friend Lee, and we spotted this Corton steel, rustic-esque tall sign saying Garden Museum. I walk into reception, and in between the humdrum of trying to find somebody for Peter to talk to, a gentleman walked in the door and said I was due to go on an episode of a podcast from Dublin. And I said, would that be with a very good-looking guy with an Irish accent? And it transpires that Jane Perrone from The Guardian had actually put the two of us in touch with each other, and I was due to get a call anyway.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sideshow Garden Podcast.
I'm Christopher Woodward, I'm the director of the Garden Museum, and I was feeling guilty because we opened yesterday and I had a queue of emails to get back on top of, and I wanted to tell you in particular about the Eileen Hogan exhibition, which I hope you'll see, which is an exhibition where someone drew and painted 90 green spaces in London. As the museum is very much about, it's as much about the green spaces of London as it is about the private garden in Hampshire.
What's the history to the Garden Museum? Because am I correct in saying that this building, this beautiful structure that I'm sitting in the middle of, was at one point about to be flattened and turned into a car park?
Yeah, we would have been sitting in the possible car park. I think what happened was in that, if you look at that church there, which looks very handsome to us now, restored, if you were the vicar here in the 1960s, it was a pretty daunting building. It was leaking, it was stained, it was derelict. And the vicar wanted to have a place for the community, and he took the congregation to a new church about 300 metres away, which still thrives. That left this building open, and I think it's very hard to criticise what was happening at that time. There wasn't a heritage lottery fund, there weren't the funding bodies. And the museum came into being because a lady called Mrs. Nicholson, who was a fan of John Tedesco, came to look at that tomb there where you see three people talking. She crossed Lambeth Bridge and walked through the sort of... They filmed The Omen in here. It was that kind of creepy. Gregory Peck was in here filming with pigeons and monks. You know, it was a creepy building. But she came and found that curious tomb of John Tedesco, the great gardener. And that led her to set up a charity to rescue the building from destruction, which she did. Impressively, but then for a long time it was effectively empty, looking for a purpose.
So let's get to what we have at this moment in time, because what it seems to me is you have this beautifully restored, beautiful building. We're in the courtyard of it, so as you walk through you'll see the landscaping at the front is being done. We'll get to why there's a mild hiatus delay on that in just a minute. You come through what essentially is a beautiful old church, all the way straight through, and in the middle of it there is now some pretty new, albeit slightly young, but that's okay and that's allowed, but it's also a kind of a mix of new meets old. Well, how would you describe the area where we are sitting at this minute, surrounded by, I guess, restaurant, cafe on both sides?
We're sitting in a courtyard which we've built principally for education. So that room there, which is full of stuff for an event tonight, and that room there, they're both for learning. That's a big learning space that can fit 32 16-year-olds with a microscope and a plant, and we've built that for urban children to study plant biology. There's nowhere in the centre of London where you can study plants for your GCSE. Not just primary schools too, adult events too, but we wanted a building big enough for a proper classroom for children to actually get their hands on the tradescantia, the geraniums, pull them apart, plant things. This room here is very much for cooking and art, and that's our cafe, and we're sitting under a cloister. Do you want? Are we okay with the noise?
We're okay. No, that's fine.
Is something? Yeah, I just want. What would you like me to say next about the Dan Garden?
Well, let's get into you. Were you always into plants? Have you a love for plants? How did you? What's your backstory essentially? And how did you end up as the, I guess, top don of a garden museum? What attracted you to the role?
Well, I mean, you don't. I'm invisible apart from people who bump into me in the porches like you did. But the I had a garden when I was a teenager, and I would spend my pocket money on plants. I earned £1.08 an hour in the village store for sweeping up at the end of school, and I would spend that at the garden centre. And and biscuits. So I suppose when this job came up, I had some what's the word, Peter? That sort of your, that's all comes back up. But I'm an art historian. I was at the Soame Museum. I ran a museum called the Holborn Museum of Bath before coming here. And I thought what I was intrigued by was just the story of garden history and the fact there wasn't a proper museum dedicated to that story and its importance in British cultural life.
What is the reaction, I guess, when you turn around and say, well, how do I ask this? So, like, what was your last job before here?
I was at the Holborn Museum in Bath, so I was, which is a big grand art museum with a great classical portico, lots of old masters on the walls, and I like cities, and I think for me this museum is very much about the city. The garden we're sitting in, to me it's really important that anyone who comes here, and yes there's an admission charge, but many people can come here for free, particularly local residents. I think it's really important that people sitting here can enjoy a Dan Pearson garden, who otherwise will never see one apart from a glimpse perhaps at the Chelsea Flower Show, or... unless they happen to be very rich. So I wanted to make a garden that had a domestic scale that people could, like the people sitting behind us on this bench, could just come and sit here and enjoy.
Well, let's go to that level then. You bring in a name as, I'm hesitant to say household, but as premier, yeah. If I might call him as Dan. How does that negotiation go? I won't say negotiation, but you get what I'm saying. Do you, when you bring Dan into a space like this, which essentially is incomplete, and you say we want to put a garden here and here, does he turn around and say, well, let me see if I would like to have tea with you?
Or we're in a funny position because a lot of what we do here, all the star designers come here to give lectures. One great value of this place is that artists and architects have forums where they can share their ideas, their influences, exchange ideas, tell the stories behind their lives. And garden designers never had that. So we a lot of... Peter, can I just come back to that? Because I just want to say something about...
That's, he keeps on walking away partway through the interviews.
No,
it's not live. It's just, you know, I've got to
worry about. I want the visitors to be. I'm anxious that the visitors are getting their lunch.
You remind me of my mom. My mom used to, you know, she'd sit down for dinner, but she never actually sat down and had her dinner with you because I'm one of eight.
Too. Yeah, exactly. We're Dan Pearson. I mean, we've had. Dan is a neighbour. His office is 10 minutes walk away. His team come to help plant. So it's a very happy relationship we have. And what I'm pleased about with this is that we've been able to give him an uncompromised role, both in terms of funding. This is called the Sackler Garden, and the garden is fully funded by a donor. But in terms of working with the architects, one reason we chose these architects was their willingness to share space with a garden designer. As you know, the traditional pattern is that the garden designer is brought in at the end of the project or when planning permission is required. And I think from the very beginning, Dan has been working with Dow Jones, they're called, who are a husband and wife couple in their 40s in South London. And so what I'm also proud of is I can't tell you the names of these plants, but I know that Dan's been able to do what he wants, and I think he's a genius, and I think it's really, as a curator, it's a really exciting thing to be able to give someone who's so good at what they do a free place for their expression.
Well, I had a conversation with Andrew Wilson and Gavin McWilliam at around the time of Chelsea, and what I said to them about their own garden there was, number one, when you see a lady on the far side of a bar or a gentleman or whatever the case may be, you when you fall in love, when you turn around and say, hold my hand, we're going to run away into the sunset together, like as in the movies, she will either say, yeah, let's do it, or she'll query it. Equally, when you fall in love, you just fall in love. You don't isolate the individual pieces down. You tend to notice it en masse, and everything is beautiful. Even the flaws are flawless. They just add to the character of it. So you've got this old mix of new, old and new, my apologies. Neither looks out of place. It looks as though it's being taken into consideration. And the planting, rightly, very, very rightly so, adds into it. But you've got new... what appear to be reclaimed cobbles next to stones. Let me try and read this one, which is dating back to 1827 and 1795. It's a, it's if you got this wrong, if you tried to make that falling in love bit into an equation
right.
and replicate it, it would have been flawed. But you seem to have got it right from the get-go.
I'm glad you think that, because you're, you know, it's just that nervous moment where we're sitting here watching people arrive. I mean, I'm what you're describing exactly. You have this building which is nearly 1,000 years old. 20,000 people are buried here, and one balance has been preserving that solemnity of respecting the past without making it feel gloomy. We didn't want it to feel like a graveyard with a planted up graveyard. And so that was Dan's idea, to mix those slabs with the planting and to use them as viewing platforms. And I also hope that when you step into the interior, that the contemporary intervention into the historic church feels quite playful and balanced too. You judge. You're the writer. I mean, I'm just happy seeing people explore the space and sitting down on that bench and sort of soaking it up. But it's what I also like is, as every time we talk, a siren goes past. This is a very fractured central part of London, and you get these glimpses through from the road now into the garden. It'll be lit up at night, and I love seeing people's intrigue at that.
You, when we first sat down, I was suggesting maybe we should go somewhere quieter, and you said, no, let's stay here. Let the sirens in as the background noise. Why is that important to you?
I think that you want to be set apart. Sorry, let me rephrase that. This is an urban building. The bronze that it's clad with will patinate with the city. It won't become green because it's bronze, but it will become spattered with the city. And we want it to be like the plane trees, that same texture, because they seem to us to be very London. When you're inside, we want your mind to travel far back into distant gardens, whether it's watching a film about Beth Chatto, which is playing at the present, or looking at old tools or paintings. But I think that we want people to remember that we're in a city, and a lot of what we do is trying to get people to change perceptions of the city around them. One thing that's really important is how fragile green space is in this particular borough, Lambeth, just due to the increase in population but also in development. The amount of green space per head has dropped by a fifth in the last 10 years, and that's nobody's fault. It's just happened. Does that answer your question, Peter?
I think it kind of does a little bit, yeah.
And the garden at the front, there's a second garden which we're just digging at the moment, which is also part of the noise, and that's designed by Christopher Bradley Hull very much as a forecourt, in a very different style to Dan Pearson. It's very much about space and hedging and paving, and that is designed to begin a process by which you step away from the city, preserve glimpses outward, but begin to feel... you begin that process of things slipping away from your mind. Gardens are so much about space. We think that gardens are about plants, but how many times can you make a garden without a boundary?
Well, the only thing I ever knew about gardens, irrespective of whether people agree, like them, disagree, that's always allowed. It's like a football team or your favourite musician or band. But gardens without people are pointless spaces. And that's the one thing that I was always told as a guy going up through horticultural college.
Right.
They are pointless. They are like hidden art gems, but nobody has ever seen them. They mean nothing.
I agree. I think there's always something slightly strange about gardens that are for one person's enjoyment, and when you look at the exhibits here, which might just be photographs, they might be an album, they might be a diary, it might be a painting, but they're very much about people expressing themselves through gardens. That's what we do through gardens. We express ourselves, and we express our individuality.
Okay, well, why did you take one garden designer for an internal let's call it the courtyard for the minute, and the front part was a separate garden designer?
We wanted two very different approaches. I mean, a lot of garden design students come here, or a lot of people, more importantly, who have never thought about garden design, and we want people to think, ah, what was the brief? That's interesting. How did he respond? So we think by having two such contrasting approaches, it will make people debate amongst themselves what garden design is.
But the courtyard, let's call it, is separated by essentially two large sheets of glass where people are sitting in front of me now and enjoying a little bit of lunch, which is beautiful to see. You've got, as you rightly said, slap bang, well, I won't say slap bang, but London nonetheless, which is a far cry away from where I live in farmland, county nowhere in Dublin. This amount of traffic, well, we'd find sheep would make more noise where I live, or maybe a tractor coming home late at night. It's quite unusual in London to find a space which is garden on both sides of where you are actually sitting while you are eating lunch.
I hope so. I hope that feels really special. I mean, that's what we've been working to do, and we didn't have the money for the Chris Bradley Hill Garden, but we thought, said let's start. And it's the perversity of the museum is that when I started, there was a great debate about whether the museum at that time, still quite an empty building, there was no heating, no. There was kind of one loo that was broken, and it was the trustees, who were very bold but responsible trustees, said, is this the right place? And we spent the first few years working out whether it was the right place. And we could have moved to the wing of a country house in the country, and we would have had a guaranteed flow of horticultural visitors. But what's excited me about being here is being dropped into the middle of the city. When you climb the tower, which you can, you realize you're dropped into the middle of the city, but it also excites me that the contrast, as you describe, is so much greater. And with the children within, if you draw a 2.5 mile radius around the museum, there are over 150 schools and nurseries and academies, and 2/3 of the kids won't have a garden of their own. And I love, now we're open again, seeing the children just handling plants. It sounds really corny, but many of them have never, ever put their hands in mud before.
2/3 of children without a garden is a staggering statistic. Again, considering just what I grew up with, which everybody knows, Sideshow Bingo, Peter growing plants under his bed at 5 years of age. Yeah. You know, it's on par with you spending your pocket money on plants and biscuits. It's at that level, but I can't picture a scenario where I did not wake up in the morning, walk out, and daisies are beneath my feet. It does not make logic sense.
And it all comes back to us as well. I mean, it's so many people, when they come to gardening later in life, they're actually returning to their childhood, whether it's Gertrude Jekyll returning to her childhood love, or friends of mine who are finishing jobs in marketing to become florists. And I grew up with a garden, we all gardened, and you have exactly those memories. I think it takes you in different directions. We didn't have a television because my parents didn't approve of them, and there were 3 families in the village who didn't have a television. There was the communists, a very poor family, and the Woodwards, and we all felt rather left out of the conversations at school. And that's taken me in a certain direction. I still don't have a telly, but I think that the children coming here who don't grow up with a garden, they will come into plants by different routes, and I don't know where it will go, Peter. I just like seeing children close up with these wondrous things that we all love that are plants.
Well, as a guy who's one of 8 children, the standard joke was we didn't even have a radio, never mind a television, but we leave that and my mom's wry wit very much to one side. I'll go back on 2 things that I have admiration for, and I did note it a little bit previously, but interaction between new and old in building on one hand, and the next level between the landscape being internal and external by both the contractors, and its, I guess, symbiotic relationship, that flawless beauty between what is building and what is landscaping. It is correct in what you said, it is rarely, if ever, taken into consideration in new builds in Ireland, in the UK. It is usually built, the landscaping is almost designed by the building contractor, if not the plasterer or the bricklayer, just because he had nothing else to do during his lunch break. And you kind of fill in the blank with some root ball hedging, which looks quite grand, but nobody knows that Prunus lusitanica is going to grow to 30 plus foot tall, and that's it. And it's a bit dull grey and beige, but there you go, there's our token gesture of planting.
But the architects too, Peter, because I think the architect here, I mean, I'm very pleased because that's what we've been working towards, is that reaction which you've described. So I'm happy now. But I think the architect here has been quite generous in giving not so much the physical space, but giving the garden pride of place. This is like what we're looking at. It's almost like the garden is what's on the stage.
Yeah, but okay, and there's our token gesture. going past.
Yeah.
There is that bit where it always strikes me that sometimes the architect wants to turn around and say, well, I did, you know, such and such a building, the Burj Al Arab, let's say, for example. The focus is solely on the building. It's rarely on, let's say, the landscape. Obviously, that's a ridiculous scenario, but you get the point I'm making.
They like Silver Birch's architects in the same way they like Anglepoise lamps. They like plants that do what they're told.
Okay, well, Silver Birch are the standard staple diet of, yeah, let's be frank about this, but if you want to win a medal at a show garden, then that's kind of the direction you're kind of heading into. In your case, what was the delay to the building out the front, the landscaping at the front?
Just because we thought... when we began, we closed 18 months ago, we were quite nervous. We were still fundraising. And there was a point where we thought, look, once we open, we're never going to have a chance to dig up the front. And let's try and raise some more money. And we had just enough funding to get started. So we were just putting in the hedges and the gravel. The stone is yet to come. And I think we just felt everything we should have a signature garden at the front. We should have a garden that's powerful at the front too.
But am I correct in remembering that you passed across some, pottery or bones while you were in the dig?
We discovers and vaults. We found five archbishops. So it's been quite a fraught thing. And then, the other garden is that across, beyond the hoarding, there's a triangular garden which our volunteers have planted. It's really beautiful at the moment. It's just all flowers just over there. And they worked on that all through the closure period. And I'm really proud of it when I see people walking through. So we've made a third garden, if you like, but is a very floral garden just over the fence, and that adds to this oasis, the dimensions of our oasis. The fact is, you know, that when you make a statement about what your values are as a museum, and when we tell architects off for, as it were, for not investing in greenness, you realize you have to do it yourself, don't you?
Yeah, well, I've great time for an architect. Well, I've great time for somebody who will turn around and say, we need more green. We don't just want a grand kitchen. And invariably, it is always the case where I will get the nod saying, look, the build of the kitchen went over by 120,000. The landscaping budget has been cut by 140.
The words value engineering to a landscape architect are the silver bullet. They go white, because in any project, as soon as someone says we're over budget, three skips later, someone says landscape, as you know. So I just hope people like this. I think what Dan has done is very subtle. It's very green. It's very much about the shape of leaf. It's all going to... This is only 2 weeks old, and it's all going to become quite a mat spilling over the footpath. Mm. And I hope that people give it the time to sit and look at it.
For those who have never been to the Garden Museum before, if you were to arrive here on a random Sunday, Saturday, Monday day, how long does it take, or how long would you suggest somebody allow?
Well, I think what the big change when you go in is that you've now got effectively 1,000 objects to look at upstairs. It's better for children because there are interactives, there are things for children to do. And then I would say 45 minutes upstairs, half an hour in the gardens, and then have lunch. You can hear... tables being laid. This is our new cafe, and there's two very good chefs called Harry Kaufman and George Ryle, who are cooking for the first time today.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Nicola, this is Peter, who I've been in touch with, who
hello.
We happily, when I realised I wondered whether he was the person I'd been in touch with. So.
Hello.
I'd quite like you to look inside and see what's on display.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Is that okay? Yeah. And then I think it's great that we're doing the garden. It's just that I think that's. But I'm here. I'm not going anywhere. It's just I want.
You stay where you are.
Right. So he's gone and done another dilly dally around the place. You are?
I'm Nicola. So I'm the press and marketing officer at the museum.
Okay. So what I wanted to ask him was, how much does it cost to come into the Garden Museum?
So it's £10 to get in for an adult, but then we've also got concessions. So over 65s are £8.50. Children under 6 are free. It's £3 to go up the tower as well. I don't know if you've spoken about that, but we've got a medieval tower which has 131 steps. And after you climb up that, you get an amazing view over Westminster.
Is it worth the £3?
Oh, it's absolutely worth £3. It's also worth the climbing up of the steps, which I think is a lot harder.
Okay. Do you do it regularly?
I've done it quite a few times, yes.
Yeah, a nice way to keep fit. What is the exact address here? Do you know that?
5 Lambeth Palace Road.
The alternative to that is you come to Ballybohole, where I live, in North County Dublin. You can knock on my front door and you can have a couple of two spots whilst we admire the barley and the sheep on the far side of the road. But then you don't have 140 steps upwards looking over a beautiful city. So we did, in fact, do the 131 steps to the top. To say it's tough on the old bones is possibly an understatement. However, the view at the top is extremely worthwhile. At Sudshow on Twitter, facebook.com/thesudshow.com. And I'll have a wee little video and a couple of photographs from the top. It is beautiful. Who am I standing beside now?
Emma House. I'm the curator at the Garden Museum.
Talk to me a little bit about the collections, and I don't know, January, February I visit, and then I come again in, let's say, August, September. Will it be the same? Will some of it remain the same? How will they change?
So we have a permanent display here which looks at the history of gardening, and we also have a number of temporary exhibition spaces. So our temporary exhibition spaces will change about 3 times a year, so we will have something different to see every time you come.
I was up and I was taking a walk around. They've got designs going back to, you know, early 1800, what I shall rephrase as low maintenance gardens, which were, I guess, now looking back at that, quite simplistic. But it goes up to the more, I guess, what maybe might bring a smile to some people's faces. There's magazine covers with Charlie Dimmock and Alan Titchmarsh and jumpers that were worn on Gardener's World. And I mean, it's quite an eclectic mix of modern and old rather than just the old, which I guess is maybe what I expected.
So our collection covers everything from the history of gardening, right back to the 17th century when the Tradescants started gardening and bringing in plants from all over Europe, right to the present day when people like Charlie Dimmock are gardening and showing people how to do something interesting, exciting with their own back garden.
Why did you mix the old with the new? And it's not to be critical. I mean, again, it made me smile because, I mean, if I go to the, you know, the Natural History Museum, that, you know, it's everything is preserved in formaldehyde. It smells of old leather book bound. It's not going to be, in my head, modernised unless somebody invents a new species, if that makes any sense, to differentiate from what you do.
I think historical pieces which look at gardening are important because they influence what we do as gardeners today. But gardening is very much something that's alive and changing with the seasons. So we wanted to bring our collections right up to date so that gardeners that are working on a project right now can come and have a look at our collections and still take something away with it for them.
To put in context, okay, so there's bulb planter up there, which and a cucumber straightener, which I believe that's not allowed anymore. At all of these old implements that, you know, you might have seen in your grandfather's shed, and it's so unusual. I mean, one of the conversations I had was that at 6 years of age, I could go down and buy powdered simazine, a chemical which is now banned. We used to use it to prevent weed seed germination. You've got the old, like, it's all there. It's literally like reeling years and going, gee, I remember that.
So some of our old tools are absolutely fascinating, and there's a lot of innovation in the history of gardening. So something like the lawnmower becomes more and more advanced. It starts off as quite a difficult tool to use that you need to use with a horse and pony, and then as it becomes more mechanized and mass produced, anyone can use it in their back garden. So there's a lot of innovation in the history of garden and gardening tools, and so that's something that our collections are really strong in. And something like the cucumber straightener is just a beautiful object to look at, but it's also got an absolutely fascinating history, because Stevenson, the railway engineer, designed it, and he wanted straighter cucumbers in his glass house, so he came up with something to solve that problem. And there's just something that's really fascinating about the history of some of the tools and how that people have designed something just to deal with quite a simple problem.
Well, but I understand maybe the man's, no, I don't understand his frustration, but he invented one nonetheless. Look, all I can say is, look, we were here myself, Ben Brace, that is, Lee Connolly, both former guests of the show, and we were taking a walk around. There's moms here with their children, there's groups of men sitting outside having lunch in the garden, there's families coming in, there were ladies behind us going up to view the top of the tower. To say it's eclectic is for the greater, not for to make it sound in any way different, but there's literally something here for everything. There's floral displays going on in front of me. 10 quid in the door and 3 quid to the top. Would I pay it all over again? Absolutely. It's been a real pleasure, a real treat, and thank you so very much. I had a beautiful time here.
Thank you. Come and visit us again.
I will indeed. Okay, if you're listening at home, Anthony Need at Sudshow on Twitter, facebook.com/thesudshow, sudshow.com. It'll put you directly in touch with them, but highly recommend it. Have a great weekend. Chat soon. Take care.